ever felt overwhelmed by endless do this but don't do that advice on what you eat and how you live? Do you struggle making sustainable choices in your daily life because it just seems so complicated or expensive? Imagine a world where each small choice could help heal our planet, improve your health, and strengthen your community and local economy. What if I told you that it's possible? What if you could make informed decisions that have a big impact with just a little effort? My name is Dana DePrima, and this is One Bite is Everything. In every episode, my curious friend, you and I unpack a tiny corner of the world with the help of an unlikely expert you might not otherwise meet. I've been doing this since 2019, and one thing I've learned is that every small action counts, and that being informed can transform your life and your community. After years of asking questions of wildly different sources, from farmers and homesteaders to policymakers and thought leaders, I've made it my mission to help you navigate the complexities and concerns that modern living poses by connecting you to questions with answers, problems with actions, and surprising insights that will keep you curious. Let's take a bite together. Everybody has a dream. A big one, a small one. One that they talk about all the time, and others that are secret. Mary Avalone had a dream, and pretty much everyone said it was impossible, that it couldn't be done. All she had was a dream and a little dirt-covered notebook.
When I was at our original home, the Flower House, there's a sidewalk right next to the largest perennial garden up for the house, which is about 100 feet long and about 12 feet deep. So I can have a lot of flowers in there, and had lots of different layers and textures going on. So it needed a lot of maintenance. I was always literally right on the edge of the sidewalk, many times a week, cleaning and prepping and cleaning the actual bed. So when people would walk by, they would say, here I am in the dirt, pop out of the flowers. And they would say, oh, I love your flowers. Or do you ever sell flowers? If you have extras, could you please let me know? And I'm out in the garden. So I would run to my little bag of all my tools. And in one little pocket, I kept a notebook with this tiny little pen, and I would whip it out and I would write down their name and telephone number, and that is it. And so there's all of these scratch names and numbers with dirt and random names in that. And so when the time came to reach out to people when I had extra, I had to find my little book, and I literally just started texting telephone numbers. Some of the people, I didn't even associate the name with the number. And I literally just started texting them in my bathrobe saying, I have extra flowers this morning. And the first time I did that was a Sunday morning when I had extra tulips. And I texted, like, I don't remember how many names. It wasn't a lot. It may have been like 12 or 14 names. I have some extra flowers. I had a little picture with it, and everybody wanted the flowers. And they're like, I'm going to be over right now. And I'm like, we're in our bathrobes. We got to harvest the tulips now. They're coming. By the time we had harvested, they were at the front door and all the tulips were gone.
The enthusiasm from that little notebook was real and growing. So Mary needed to hatch a plan to keep up with demand. She reached out to a vegetable farmer that she had met at the farmer's market. Here's what she said.
I would love it if I could barter for some land. Just a little bit. Just, you know, 10 feet by 50 something. Could I just have a little bit of land and I would provide some services for you on the farm? So we made our little agreement, and I was going to grow more of the dahlias in that little tiny little space that was more than what I had now, and I was thrilled. And she decided, well, why don't we just try some more flowers than just that spot? You take your spot, and why don't we together learn how to grow flowers on a bigger scale? So it ended up being about 80 by 80. Well, that was a lot. So I started taking classes and figuring it all out. And that year I sold a lot of flowers, and the town allowed me to sell flowers on my property. So I would take the extra flowers and sell them in this little tiny little nook by the side of the garage. And then that quickly became insufficient. And my husband then built what's called the Flower Shack, which is a cute little shack at the end of the driveway. And I just kept selling flowers. And COVID hit, and then the flowers went berserk because it became a destination for people to come outdoors and buy something beautiful, make them feel good, be able to share. They weren't in a store, and I was selling as fast as I could cut the flowers.
From a little dirt-covered notebook and a creative arrangement for more land on which to grow more, Mary's business got off the ground.
So it was a perfect combination of timing and experience and exposure. And I just started selling more flowers, and it just took off from there. I joined what's called the Connecticut Flower Collective, which is the largest flower collective in the country. We're 25 flower farmers, and we come together and we sell our flowers Wednesday through Saturday. So it just sort of evolved, and then I evolved with it. And my husband and I had been looking for property all along, not necessarily for flowers, but we wanted more space to be able to do what we wanted to do. And then we found this place. So after 5 years of really looking and bartering for land for quite some time, which isn't necessarily the best way of growing a business, it's been an adventure. I've learned an incredible amount along the way, and I've had a lot of support from actually other farmers from a distance through the community across the country, whether I meet them on Instagram or Facebook. And the local community has certainly been supportive, but I've learned most coming from other farmers across the country, which has been amazing. So you know, I thank them all the time because I couldn't do it without them. And some of them come to me now. I mean, I got a lot of people coming to me now because what I've done is what lots of farmers want to do is take such a little piece of property and make it viable.
And now you're viable.
100% viable. They all said, you can't do it. And I said, well, we'll see how we do. Was it perfect? No. Was it viable? Yes. Did I make money? Yes. Did I surprise everybody? Yes. Was it way more work than I even humanly possibly imagined? Yes.
The naysayers were many, but mostly they were experts who saw how small the land was and the terrible condition of the soil. Not only that, but Mary was on a push time-wise. The demand was breathing down her neck.
I mean, basically we went from a wooded junkyard to a high-class field for growing. We did that in 2 months. We had no choice. So was it ideal? No. Did we know that we were going to have issues? And without irrigation, nonetheless. So they said, it's not feasible. And I said, well, we're going to make it feasible. I was climbing a ladder to get water and carry it. That's what it takes. The tenacity, the grit. If you want it that badly, you're going to get it. So we'll be going into the third year of growing on this particular property, and we're looking way better than we were this time 2 years ago.
So your challenges, the ones you can't control, come in the form of lots of rain or no rain or just mainly weather. Is that your biggest challenge now?
Certainly Mother Nature, through all of those things you just mentioned, whether it's rain, temperature, wind, bugs, all different types of pressures, but it's getting the soil to do what we need it to do in order to have the best quality product. So that you can't do overnight. And when you're starting with such a poor quality product, you can only amend and make changes so much, as well as have the proper drainage with that and have the appropriate soil content for the plants. So it's a process.
Now, let's back up for a minute. You obviously did not just start growing flowers. You've been growing flowers for yourself because they speak to you in some way. Tell me a little bit about your history and experience with this kind of growing.
So I've been growing flowers basically as long as I can remember as an adult. It just sort of happened by chance that I was able to grow as many flowers as I was when I was so young. And I was living in a two-family home in Cromwell, Connecticut at the time with an elderly couple, and she loved to grow flowers. And her garden in the front was beautiful. And she always said, "Mary, you really need some flowers along the fence." And I would say, "Miss M, I just don't have the funds to grow flowers along the fence." "I'll give you some." "Really?" She said, "We can dig up some dirt and I'll give you some flowers. The landlord won't care." I said, "Great." So one day she gave me a few flowers, and perennials, I should say. And so I started putting them along my fence and they grew. I was like, "Wow, look at that. I didn't kill them." And I was amazed. And so I'd buy a few more on my own up the street from the nursery. And I just thought it was amazing that I could just put them in the ground and they would grow. And I moved from that house and I took all my flowers and some of Mrs. M's to the new location. And I asked the landlord, "Can I have a bigger garden?" He said, "Sure." So I made this big garden and grew tons of flowers and I loved it. And then when I moved to the house that I was in for a long time that we're selling, I moved all those flowers. I rototilled a huge area. It was the wrong time of the year to move the flowers. I didn't care. And I moved all the flowers over and started really delving into growing flowers, growing perennials. I started taking classes, learning about landscaping and design work. And that's where the flower house began. So it evolved over time, and collecting perennials is a hobby. It takes time, and there's an expense. And much younger, I didn't have the discretionary income just to be buying whatever I wished. So I spent a long time doing research, learning about plants, having my wish lists, and then adding as I could. So definitely a labor of love.
I love that what Mrs. M might think now.
Yes, and it warms my heart that I still have Mrs. M's flowers with me today. I've moved them from place to place to place. And I see her son in town sometimes. And I always let him know that I still have her flowers with me. And he loves that. So, she's still part of me wherever I go. And the wisdom that she gave me is just great.
Mary's obsession started with Mrs. M and it grew to a bit of an addiction. And that condition is contagious. It's spreading across the country and not just with flower farmers.
A little bit of gardening can go a long way. You just never know how big the addiction's gonna get, as we say. So mine's a little bit on the big side now. I get to make a living doing it. So aren't I lucky?
There is, I think, a national addiction to dahlias. What the heck is going on? Why are people so obsessed? What is the deal with the dahlia obsession?
There's many factors, one being gardening in general because of COVID, several major books that have been published. So that has bring more exposure to dahlias and brought that to light. And I think that people have more accessibility to dahlias in general. They're sold in lots of different places and they have their a variety of colors and shapes and sizes. And so people look at it as something that they can start with and then they learn more about it and it quickly evolves into, oh, I could collect this one and I can collect that one. We innately as people love to collect things. We love to have things. Growing up, you had a stamp collection or you had a sticker collection or you had a sneaker collection. We love having something that we call our own. And so I think that dahlias allow us to have something that's reflective of us, whether we want to collect purple ones or tall ones or big ones or loud ones. And it's an expression that we're able to simply collect them and learn along the way. So dahlias are amazing flowers. Actually, they're relatively easy to grow. You can grow them in a pot, you can grow them in a grow bag, and you literally just put them in the ground and they will grow. What you were referring to is taking them out if you're in a zone where it's cold. So in different parts of the country, dahlias can stay in the ground. There's no reason to take them out of the ground. Where they started in the high mountains, they never were taken out of the ground in Mexico. So in colder zones, they do need to be lifted because the part that goes into the ground, their tuber, could freeze if the temperatures get too cold. That's part of the process of learning something that we love to do, no matter what hobby it may be. Whether you're learning to ride a bicycle and you need to learn how to do certain things to take care of the bike, this is the same way. We have to learn our hobby and learn how to save the tubers if that's what we want to do, or make them grow better by adding different fertilizers and so on and so forth.
For those new to the wild world of dahlias, tubers are the underground storage structure of the dahlia plant that can be separated from the dahlia to be propagated to grow new dahlias. There is a huge market for tubers right now, as more and more people are growing dahlias as a hobby. So for dahlia farmers, not only can they sell the actual flower, they can also sell the tubers separately for consumers to start growing their own, a great business model, especially since the demand is at an all-time high right now.
So I think that dahlias are a manageable hobby, and there are thousands of dahlias. And you can grow up dahlias by seed and have your very own dahlia that nobody else has. And so I think that it touches upon so many different people. And dahlias are grown internationally. And they definitely pull at the heartstrings of so many people, because the younger generation today is now finding out that their grandparents grew dahlias way back when. And they would say, oh, I remember when I went to a grandma's house and we had dahlias on the table. Now I can grow dahlias too. So the circle is coming back. And I think that people are really just diving into it head first, from the young generation to the much older generation. We're all on the same playing field and we're all just obsessed with dahlias. So I think it's amazing. I love them. And each one has its own personality. So I think that's what's so amazing.
Now, you sell the tubers. So when you take your dahlias out of the ground, you've got a clump of tubers for any one plant, and you can break those down. And each one can potentially be a new plant. And so you are selling off some of your tubers for your farm?
Correct. So that's one of the ways flower farmers generate income from dahlias, not just selling their actual bloom, but if they're going to harvest the actual tubers, they would lift the clump out of the ground and then process by dividing the dahlia clump itself, which has many babies, as we say. And if the tuber itself is viable, it can then be sold. Every single solitary one may not be one that's sellable, but as many as we can sell, that is a way for us to generate income as a farm that grows dahlias.
Now, when you're selling your dahlias or your tubers, are you selling them in person or are you selling them online?
I would say most of it's all sold online. I haven't decided if I have any extras, whether I'll sell them here on the farm, but most of them, 98% of them, I'll sell online. It's where I reach the biggest audience, and I can sell anywhere in the US, anywhere where US mail will ship to.
Okay. And just to continue the dissection of this obsession, these online sales, people are nuts about getting the tuber for the unicorn dahlia of some sort in their heart, right, their mind, that they must have. I need to understand this a little bit more.
There are what's called the dahlia wars. They're literally called the dahlia wars. So what's happened is there's a vast increase of people who want dahlias. So we're going from flower farmers that have been farming all along, and now we have a huge increase of people who want the tubers. So that in and of itself creates a higher demand for the product that's grown across the country by flower farmers. When the flower farmers can't produce as much as the demand, then everything gets heightened even more. So if we only have 100 to sell and there are 1,000 people who want that, well, then it creates a little bit of discourse out there. So what happens is people line up online trying to get that one, whatever that one might be that they want. And so through the course of the growing year across the world, not just here in the US, this is not just a US phenomenon. What's happening is new dahlias are coming onto the market, whether they're being hybridized by hand, some very well-known ones here in the US, as well as ones from overseas. We have lots of hybridizers that people follow. They want their newest and greatest. And so the hybridizers are stepping up to the plate and creating more dahlias. It takes about 4 years or more for a dahlia, a new dahlia, to go from, let's say, the earliest stages to the market. So it takes quite a while for that dahlia to come to the market. And all that while, they're able to say, hey, look what's coming. Look at this beauty. I love it. And so the hype builds and people say, well, I want to add that to my collection. By the time it gets released, everybody knows about it and they want what they want, right? So it's no different than any other organization or any other product that's new that comes to the market. You could take like Apple, for instance. When they're going to release their new iPhone, they talk about it and then the lines are wicked long at the store. People, they camp out, they do all kinds of crazy things just to get the newest product. No different than Cabbage Patch, no different than all these things over the years, as we say, the newest car, the newest, whatever it is, it's just what happens. People want the newest or what somebody else doesn't have. It doesn't mean that that new thing is the best. They perceive that it is and they want that. So what happens is the unicorns, as you call them, evolve and those unicorns change season to season and people chase their rainbow hoping that they're going to get that specific dahlia. So a lot of different things going on in the dahlia world. And I try to keep things at bay, as fair as possible. And I do have some amazing new dahlias coming out. So I won't be feeding the madness. Mine are known dahlias that are coming from overseas that have made their way here that have very little exposure. I'm excited to bring those to the market in a little bit bigger way. And that's going to take a few years because they take a little while.
So in your inventory, are people interested in those new ones most, or are there some other tubers that they're really looking at?
There's a variety of different dahlias just on the market. Like I said, there's thousands of dahlias. And what you want to grow in your garden is going to be very different than when somebody else does. So what you're looking for when you go shopping varies greatly. I try to have as many what I call good bones, the ones that are always reliable, the ones that you can always count on, the ones that aren't fussy, the ones that are going to make your garden and your field look the best and are going to be the most productive. That's the object of the game, to have lots of flowers.
When a unicorn tuber hits the market, the mad dash to be the first to have it is quite similar to what Mary mentioned earlier with iPhones, sneakers, children's toys, or whatever the world decides is trendy and valuable at the time. People will wait at their computer with their finger on the trigger with only 15 seconds to make their purchase. Yes, that's right. Unicorn dahlia tubers can sell out within 15 seconds of hitting the online market. Like I said earlier, the dahlia craze is real and thriving. However, there are a lot of people that don't like to shop this way and are willing to make a concession to buy tubers that don't have all the hype that unicorn tubers may have.
The American Dahlias Association has 33 different clubs nationwide. And I believe the majority of them do have sales where they're in-person sales. And those are way more relaxed, where you go in and you can physically touch and see your tuber and buy them that way. So a lot of people are working more towards enlarging the dahlia societies locally so that those in sales are more productive and more user-friendly than going online and feeling like you're trapped on your computer at all hours of the day and night.
Are you out there shopping for anything in particular?
Yes, and I am just like everybody else. And I think that's one of the things that I love to have people keep in mind. Just because I'm a flower farmer doesn't mean I get preference going to somebody else's site. I'm shopping just like they are, and I'm waiting in line, and I have my things all set ready to go, and it my fingers are just like their fingers, so I don't have any special treatment, and it takes me years sometimes to get ones that I really like.
So tell me one that you either got already this year that's new, or one that you're hot on the trail of.
Oh, wait a minute, I'm gonna give away my trade secrets here.
Just one, just
Just
one.
all right, let me think of one. One of the ones that I had been eyeing for a while was Ferncliff Classy. Actually, I saw somebody this morning did a little video on her. I haven't seen her to that extent. And she's a beautiful sort of rusty raspberry dahlia by Ferncliff, which is in Canada. That's the hybridizer where you can get them. And Ferncliff opened their site in the fall. And I got the email and I went flying and I dropped everything just so that I could get on the website and buy those dahlias because I had been looking for a while to purchase it. It's not one that a lot of people buy. And a lot of dahlias can't cross country lines, but Canada with a certain certificate, I can. So I'm excited to grow that one. It's different than other ones that are here in the US. And I'm thrilled that she's part of my collection. I love the Ferncliff series. I do have quite a few good ones coming. So I don't want to have a spoil. I don't want to spoil for people. But that one, if people haven't seen Ferncliff Classy, I say get on the horn because you're missing something. She's a gorgeous raspberry that's definitely worth having.
So, speaking of names, your Dreamland Flower Farm, how did that name come to be?
It actually didn't take very long to come up with Dreamland Flower Farm because everybody who comes to the house always says, "Oh, wow, it's so dreamy here. It's like a fantasy world." The place where we started, the whole property was just flowers. And so people would come from all over just to drive by this house to get out to take pictures. They're like, "This is just so dreamy. It's not like anything else I've ever seen." I'm like, "You could do this too." I said, "I don't even have a half acre." I'm like, "You can do this." And so that's where a lot of the conversations went. It fits me on so many different levels for what it means, what it stands for, and how you really can have a dream. Even if it's just sort of percolating, and how intent and how the right timing can really make something come to fruition, even if it's little to begin with.
Mary and Dreamland Flower Farm received a grant from the Four Farmers Movement in its first year of awarding grants to small and mid-sized farmers. The grants are small, but they come with a lot besides the money. For the grant, Mary requested support for a flower cooler, allowing her to harvest and protect her flowers as she's getting them to market. But here's what she has to say about the grant in general.
The grant gave me affirmation that I can move forward with this and that I have people behind me, even if it's a dollar a day, like you say. That little bit of affirmation and little bit of push every day really makes a difference, and it makes you feel like you can do something. I think that receiving a grant affirms that you're taking things in the right direction. And then it also lets me know that people are paying attention, that not only do I have accountability to myself, but I have accountability to other people that are supporting me and that I want to show them. Whether I succeed or I have failures along the way, they want to know about them because they care. And it's not just, "Oh, I'm making a donation and oh, don't I feel good because I made a donation." That's not what the Four Farmers Movement is about. It's about being along the way for the journey and seeing how the farmers are doing. And I'm not this big global person, and yet my reach is much larger. And so it warms me that I have people that follow me all over the world. I mean, it just blows my mind. And that the grant for you, the people that you're reaching are then reaching me too. So it's like all connected. And it's not just me being out there by myself, but it's all these people coming together and seeing all these different farmers for all different reasons. We're attracted to different businesses for different reasons, whether we have affinity to goats or to flowers or to sunflowers or whatever it may be. And it opens the eyes up to people to see all the different types of farming and the highs and lows that all the farmers have across the country, because we're all very different. We all have different backgrounds. Our needs are very different. And yet our goals are to have success in what we do. And everybody wants to succeed, right? So having them make their donations, however small that they are, they know that they're helping a real person. It's not some organization. You know, it's a real person, and showing them what it means gives them the affirmation that what they're doing is good too. So it's a win-win for everybody.
One little dream, one little notebook, one big passion, and a ton of grit. Mary Avalone of Dreamland Flower Farm made a go of it against the odds and made it work. Now she's a player in the Dahlia craze, advising small flower farmers across the country, fueling Dahlia Wars as a farmer who still craves the next hot bloom. And she's made the business work. It's viable and growing. It's a component of her community where her customers buy flowers that give them joy, make their homes beautiful, and grace the dinner tables where they gather. But it's more than that. Dreamland's community stretches beyond its zip code. It's an example that a small flower farm can thrive in a community. It can knit it together. Other dreamers are taking note. And the hidden impact is there too. Small flower farmers nationwide are mitigating the need for flowers to be flown in from other countries, full of pesticides and in a wake of jet fuel. Of course you want to buy your flowers locally. Look what that small action can do. Yes, a little dreamy flower farm can be everything. It's all connected. From those flowers Miss M gave Mary to her dream today. And as a word to all of us, we are supporters of dreams. That dollar that you gave to the Four Farmers Movement to support a grant has a ripple effect in Mary's garden, her local economy, the farms she supports in their communities, our environment too. You did that. One Bite is Everything, the podcast where you can have a big impact on your health, your community, and the planet through tiny, informed choices. Make sure that you follow this podcast in whatever podcast app you are listening on so you don't miss an episode. Big things are coming you will not want to miss. I am your host, Dana DePrima. Thanks for being here. See you next week